Hello and welcome to Planet in Peril. I'm your host, Alice. We're here today to discuss a really sobering new report that looks back at the last 10 years of climate change, from 2015 to 2025. It paints a picture not just of steady warming, but of a dangerous acceleration. And to help us unpack this, I'm joined by our expert panel. Welcome, Carter, Frank, and Maya.
Hi, Alice. It's great to be here. I'm Carter.
Hello, I'm Frank. Good to be on.
And I'm Maya. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive right in. Carter, this report, titled Decade of Consequence, uses some very strong language right from the start. Can you set the scene for us? What makes this last decade so pivotal and alarming?
Well, Alice, the key takeaway is that word you used, acceleration. We're no longer on a gentle, predictable upward slope. The data, and this is coming from the big global bodies like the IPCC and the World Meteorological Organization, shows that every key indicator of the planet's health sped up in the last 10 years. We've essentially pushed the global system into a new, more volatile state.
You know, that really resonates. It feels that way, doesn't it? I mean, just thinking about my own garden, the seasons feel less predictable. The summer heat seems to arrive earlier and hit harder every year. It feels less stable.
That's a great point, Maya. It's moved from an abstract concept to a lived experience for so many. Carter, let's talk about the most direct indicator, temperature. The report says records haven't just been broken, they have been shattered.
That's right. The 10-year period from 2015 to 2024 is, without a doubt, the warmest decade since we started keeping records in 1850. And it's not a fluke. Every single year within that decade is among the 10 warmest years ever recorded.
Okay, Carter, but we always hear about record-breaking years. Every year seems to be the hottest ever. How is this different? Is it just a continuation of a trend?
It is, but the trend itself is speeding up. And this decade saw something truly significant. The year 2024 became the first full calendar year where the global average temperature went past the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold from the Paris Agreement. Specifically, it hit about 1.55 degrees above the pre-industrial average.
Wow, 1.5 degrees. We've been talking about that number as a future goal, a line we must not cross, and we're already there, even temporarily. That's unsettling.
But Carter used the word temporarily. So does that mean the Paris Agreement goal is already lost? And you know, 2024 had a strong El Nino event, which is a natural warming cycle. How much of this is just nature doing its thing?
That's an excellent and crucial question, Frank. No, a single year's breach doesn't mean the goal is permanently lost, as that refers to a long-term average, but it serves as a massive warning shot. It shows that the climate system is capable of reaching these dangerous levels now. And while El Nino played a role, it was riding on top of this powerful long-term warming trend. The key isn't just one record year at the accelerating rate of warming.
Can you elaborate on that? The accelerating rate?
Of course. Data from NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, shows that since 1982, the world has been warming at a rate of 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. Now, that might not sound like much, but it's more than three times faster than the average rate since 1850. So to answer your question, Frank, this isn't a natural blip. The engine is revving faster and faster.
So let's talk about that engine. What's driving this acceleration? The report links it directly to greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Exactly. The physics are very direct. And in the last decade, the concentrations of these gases have soared to levels that are frankly unprecedented in human history. The IPCC's latest major report states with high confidence that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are now higher than at any time in at least 2 million years.
2 million years? I can't even process that number. It feels like we're running a massive uncontrolled experiment on our only home.
That's a good way to put it, Maya. To give you some concrete numbers, in 2024, the average concentration of carbon dioxide hit 422.7 parts per million. That's a full 50% higher than before the industrial age began. And just like with temperature, the rate of increase is accelerating. In the 1960s, it grew by about 0.8 parts per million per year. In the last 10 years, it's averaged 2.6 parts per million per year. The year 2024 saw the largest single-year jump ever recorded.
So the warming is accelerating, and the concentration of the gas causing the warming is also accelerating. This brings us to the core question, which is addressed in the second section of the report, the science of attribution. Carter, how certain are scientists that this is us?
the scientific community is as certain as it is about the theory of gravity. The IPCC uses the strongest possible language. The report states unequivocally that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, ocean, and land. There's no ambiguity left.
Unequivocal. That is a strong word. But what does that mean in practice? I mean, a lot of people hear this and think, okay, but how do they know it's not the sun or volcanoes or some other natural cycle?
It's a fair question. Scientists know because they use incredibly sophisticated climate models. They run simulations of the last 50 years with only natural factors, like solar cycles and volcanic eruptions. And when they do that, the models completely fail to replicate the warming we've actually observed. They just can't get the temperature to rise. It's only when they add in the human-caused greenhouse gas emissions that the models accurately match the real-world temperature record.
Oh, I see. So it's like trying to solve a mystery. You test out all the natural suspects, and none of them can be the culprit. But when you add in the human suspect, the story suddenly makes perfect sense.
That's a perfect analogy. The IPCC even quantifies it. The best estimate is that humans have caused about 1.07 degrees Celsius of warming since the late 1800s, the total observed warming over that same period, about 1.1 degrees Celsius. So we account for basically all of it.
Right. So if it's unequivocally us, what specific human activities are we talking about? When people say we need to cut emissions, what are we actually supposed to be cutting?
That's a perfect question, Frank. Carter, the report gets right into this. Can you break down the main sources for us?
Absolutely. The picture is actually very clear. The primary driver, by a huge margin, is the burning of fossil fuels, so that coal, oil, and natural gas. In 2019, about 79% of all global greenhouse gas emissions came from using fossil fuels across four main areas: energy production for electricity and heat, industry, transportation, and buildings.
So it really isn't just about driving cars. I mean, that's what you always hear. But this is about how we power our homes, how we make things, our entire economic structure.
Precisely. The power sector alone, which generates electricity and heat, is the single biggest contributor. And what's concerning is that even with the amazing growth of renewable energy, the International Energy Agency has pointed out that demand for oil and gas has stayed stubbornly high. We're still investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure, which creates a real risk of locking in these emissions for decades to come.
You know, it's so easy to picture smokestacks and the tailpipes of cars when we talk about this. But the report mentions another big piece of the puzzle, right? Something about our land, about forests and farming.
Yes, and it's a critical piece, Maya. The remaining 21 to 22% of emissions come from what scientists call AFOLU. That stands for agriculture, forestry, and other land use. This includes methane emissions from livestock, nitrous oxide from fertilizers, and crucially, deforestation.
And why is deforestation such a major factor?
It delivers a devastating 1-2 punch. First, when we clear forests, primarily for agriculture, we release the massive amounts of carbon that were stored in those trees and soils directly into the atmosphere. Between 2015 and 2020, the world continued to lose an estimated 10 million hectares of forest every single year. Second, by destroying the forest, we're eliminating a vital natural carbon sink that would otherwise be absorbing CO2 from the air. So it adds carbon while also reducing the planet's ability to clean it up.
So we have a very clear picture of the sources. This leads to the obvious question of what we are doing about it. The report talks about a persistent and vast emissions gap. Carter, what is that?
The emissions gap is the difference between what countries have pledged to do and what the science says is actually required to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. The United Nations Environment Program releases a report on this every year, and the findings are stark. The 2023 report found that with the policies we have right now, the world is on a trajectory for a temperature rise of nearly 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century.
3 degrees? Carter, we were just talking about how damaging it is to even temporarily hit 1.5 degrees. 3 sounds catastrophic.
It would be. To align with the 1.5 degree pathway, the report states that predicted global emissions in 2030 need to be cut by a staggering 42% from where they're heading now.
Hold on a minute. A 42% cut by 2030? Carter, that's just a handful of years away. Is that even realistic? Are countries just not trying, or is the goal itself simply impossible for our modern world to achieve?
It's an immense challenge, Frank. There's no question. The report does note that there has been some progress since the Paris Agreement was signed. Projected emissions for 2030 are lower now than they were expected to be a decade ago. However, this improvement is nowhere near the scale or speed that is required. So, this gap, it really represents the collective failure of the world to turn political commitments into sufficient real-world action.
And while governments and experts are debating these huge numbers and percentages, people on the ground are already feeling the effects. It feels like the consequences are here now, but the solutions are still stuck in negotiations.
Maya, that is such a powerful point, and it leads us directly to one of the most significant scientific advancements of the past decade, which is the ability to link specific weather events directly to climate change. Carter, tell us about the science of attribution.
This has been a game changer. For a long time, we could only say that climate change makes certain types of events, like heat waves, more likely in general. But now, attribution science allows scientists to provide robust, quantitative assessments of the role human-caused warming played in a specific individual event.
So how does that work, in simple terms?
They use multiple climate models to compare the probability of a specific extreme event happening in the world as it is today, with all our emissions, to its probability in a counterfactual world, a simulated world without human-caused greenhouse gases. This allows them to say, with a calculated degree of confidence, how much more likely or how much more intense an event was made because of climate change.
So you're saying that scientists can now point to a specific flood or a specific wildfire and actually put a number on it. They can say this was 50% worse or 10 times more likely because of our emissions?
Yes, exactly. Wildfire seasons have become longer and more intense in many parts of the world. Scientific analysis estimates that human-caused climate change has already doubled the area of forest burned in the western United States in recent decades. And this creates a terrifying feedback loop. These megafires don't just destroy communities, they release enormous amounts of stored carbon back into the atmosphere, which in turn causes more warming, which then leads to more fires.
I live in California, and that feedback loop is something you can feel in your bones. The fear during fire season is palpable, and even if you're not near the flames, the smoke can choke the sky for weeks. It's a constant, unhealthy reminder of what's happening.
Maya, you've taken us right to the next critical point. These disasters are not just statistics. They have a direct and severe impact on our health. The report goes so far as to call climate change the greatest global health threat of the 21st century. Carter, it is, without a doubt, the impacts are extensive.
Let's mock at the same time. It is something similar and go right from where it ends in many parts of the world. Scientific analysis estimates that human-caused climate change has already doubled the area of forest burned in the western United States in recent decades. And this creates a terrifying feedback loop. These megafires don't just destroy communities, they release enormous amounts of stored carbon back into the atmosphere, which in turn causes more warming, which then leads to more fires.
I live in California, and that feedback loop is something you can feel in your bones. The fear during fire season is palpable, and even if you're not near the flames, the smoke can choke the sky for weeks. It's a constant, unhealthy reminder of what's happening.
Maya, you've taken us right to the next critical point. These disasters are not just statistics. They have a direct and severe impact on our health. The report goes so far as to call climate change the greatest global health threat of the 21st century. Carter, it is, without a doubt, the impacts are extensive. That a craven a role,
meaning change.
Simile be lomalja, a world that is simply less alive.
We've spent this time detailing an accelerating crisis with devastating impacts on our health, our economy, and the very biodiversity of the planet. It's a stark picture, but the world has not been completely idle. The final section of the report assesses the global response.
In Edwilles, Carter, the central pillar of international climate policy over the past decade has been the Paris Agreement, adopted back in 2015.
For listeners who may not remember the details, can you remind us what it set out to achieve?
Of course, the Paris Agreement was a genuine diplomatic breakthrough. For the first time, it brought all nations, both developed and developing, into a common framework to combat climate change. Its main goals are to hold the increase in the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and to pursue efforts to limit that temperature increase even further to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
And how was it designed to achieve that? What's the actual mechanism?
The agreement operates on a 5-year cycle of what's called ratcheting ambition. The idea is that countries are required to submit their own national climate action plans, which are known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs. Then, every 5 years, they are supposed to come back to the table with a new, stronger plan that is more ambitious than their last one.
Okay, hold on. Nationally Determined Contributions. That sounds like a lot of diplomatic jargon. If I'm hearing you right, does that just mean that every country gets to make up its own plan, and there's no real penalty or enforcement if they don't follow it or if their plan is too weak?
You're not wrong, Frank. It is not an international treaty with a heavy-handed enforcement mechanism in the traditional sense. It's a framework that is built more on transparency reporting and a kind of global peer pressure. The idea is that by having everyone's commitments out in the open and by regularly taking stock of our collective progress, countries will be encouraged and expected to ramp up their efforts over time.
So it's less of a strict global law and more of a collective promise. A set of promises, really. But based on everything we've talked about today, from the shattered temperature records to the accelerating ice melt, it seems like those promises are being broken.
Maya, that takes us directly to what the report calls the ambition gap. Carter, you explained the process. Now let's talk about the reality. How big is the shortfall between what countries have promised in their NDCs and what the science tells us we actually need to do?
The shortfall is massive. It's a chasm, really. The most recent analysis from the United Nations, which looked at the latest pledges from 195 countries, concluded that we are falling miles short of what's needed. If every country fully implemented its current pledges, we would see a global emission reduction of only about 5.9% by 2030 compared to 2019 levels.
Only 6%? That sounds tiny. How does that compare to the goal?
Well, the IPCC, the main scientific body, has found that to keep the 1.5-degree limit within reach, our emissions need to be slashed by at least 43% by 2030. So we are pledging for a 6% cut when we need a 43% cut. Slim. This gap means that the sum of all these national promises currently has the world on a trajectory toward a catastrophic level of warming somewhere between 2.5 and 2.9 degrees Celsius.
That's just astounding. It's not a gap. It's a total disconnect from reality. So these huge annual conferences, the COPs we hear about on the news every year with all the world leaders, what are they actually achieving if the numbers are still this bad? Is it just a talking shop?
That's a criticism you hear a lot, and there is a great deal of frustration. These conferences are the primary venue for negotiating how to implement the Paris Agreement. They have produced some important outcomes. For instance, COP28 in Dubai produced the first ever global stocktake, which is essentially the world's climate report card. And it ended with a historic first-ever call for countries to begin transitioning away from fossil fuels.
But Carter, the language there seems so important. I remember the debate was about a phase-out of fossil fuels, but the final agreement was to transition away from them. It feels like very carefully chosen, watered-down language. Does that kind of subtle change in wording actually lead to real-world action, or does it just give countries a loophole?
That is the heart of the debate. Many nations were deeply disappointed that the language wasn't stronger. The hope is that even that language signals a clear direction to the global economy. That same conference also established a global goal to triple renewable energy capacity and double the rate of energy efficiency improvements by 2030, which are very concrete targets.
And what about the most recent conference mentioned in the report, COP29?
That was dubbed the Finance COP. Its main job was to agree on a new climate finance goal to help developing nations. After very contentious negotiations, they agreed that developed countries should lead in mobilizing at least $300 billion per year by 2035 for developing nations. But again, many of those nations expressed deep disappointment, stating that this number falls far, far short of their estimated needs, which are in the trillions.
This seems to be a recurring theme of falling short. Let's shift from the policy to the other major part of the response, which is technology. Here, the report does seem to highlight one area as a significant success story, and that is the renewables revolution.
Yes, this has been the brightest spot of the last decade, without a doubt. We've seen an absolutely explosive growth of renewable energy technologies, especially solar panels and wind power. This was driven by incredible innovation and economies of scale, and it caused the costs of solar and wind to plummet. They are now the cheapest sources of new electricity generation in most of the world. To give you a sense of the scale, in 2023, the world added a record 473 gigawatts of new renewable capacity. The International Energy Agency even forecasts that this year, in 2025, renewables will overtake coal as the single largest source of global electricity.
That's genuinely good news, and everyone loves seeing cheaper energy. But I noticed the report also says that we are still not on track to meet that COP28 goal of tripling renewable capacity by 2030. Why is that? If this technology is so cheap and effective, why aren't we just building it everywhere, all the time, as fast as we possibly can? What's the holdup?
It's a great question, Frank. The momentum is incredible, but the scale of the challenge is even bigger. To achieve that tripling goal, we would need to be adding, on average, around 1,050 gigawatts of new capacity every single year for the rest of the decade. That's more than double the record we just set in 2023. The barriers are no longer primarily about cost, they are about things like modernizing our electrical grids to handle this new type of energy, overcoming supply chain bottlenecks for components, and streamlining the permitting processes to get projects built faster. So even in this huge success story, there is a major gap between our current progress and the required pace of change.
So Carter, even our biggest technological success story, renewable energy, is facing a challenge of sheer scale and speed. The report points to another critical tool in the toolbox, something often called the first fuel, which is energy efficiency.
Now, this is something that just seems like pure common sense to me. Using less energy to get the same result, whether it's an efficient appliance or an insulated home, it saves people money on their bills, it reduces strain on the power grid, and it cuts emissions. It seems like the absolute lowest hanging fruit. Why aren't we talking about this constantly?
You are absolutely right, Frank. Improving energy efficiency is the cheapest and cleanest way to address our energy needs, which is why the COP28 goal to double the global average annual rate of energy efficiency improvements by 2030 is so critical. But the reality, as the report lays out, has been deeply disappointing.
How so? What does the data show?
After a brief speed up in 2022, which was mostly in response to the global energy crisis, the rate of global energy intensity improvement slowed way down to just 1% in both 2023 and 2024. To be on a pathway to net zero emissions, we need that rate to be averaging around 4% per year. So we are falling far short. The report effectively calls it a major and concerning policy failure on a global scale.
So if we're failing on the common sense goal of efficiency, what about the more high-tech solutions that promise to clean up our existing emissions? Carter, the report spends some time on carbon capture, utilization, and storage, or CCUS.
Again, on the surface, this sounds like a pragmatic solution. For those really difficult industries that are hard to electrify, like making cement or steel, why not just build a system to capture the carbon dioxide before it ever gets into the atmosphere? It seems like a logical way to solve the problem without having to completely shut down these essential industries overnight.
And that is exactly how it is often presented, Frank, as a necessary solution for these hard-to-abate sectors. And there is a lot of momentum in terms of announcements. The report notes there are over 700 projects in various stages of development. However, it also points to a massive gap between those announcements and the operational reality.
What do you mean by that? A gap between announcements and reality?
As of early 2024, the total global operational capacity for capturing CO2 was just over 50 million tons per year. That is a tiny fraction of what has been announced or proposed for 2030. And critically, only 20% of that announced capacity had actually reached a final investment decision. This indicates that most of these projects are still just on the drawing board, they are not yet real. So deployment has consistently and significantly lagged behind the expectations and the promises.
You know, I have to wonder if there's a risk here that this technology just becomes an excuse, a way for fossil fuel companies and heavy industries to continue polluting under the promise that someday, in the future, they'll be able to clean it all up. It feels like it could be a dangerous distraction from the real work of actually cutting emissions at the source.
Speaking of potentially dangerous and controversial ideas, the report mentions that as the world falls further behind on emissions reductions, there is a growing, albeit highly contentious, interest in something called solar geoengineering. Carter, can you even begin to explain what that is?
I can try. It's also sometimes called solar radiation modification. This refers to a set of hypothetical technologies that are designed to cool the planet by reflecting a small fraction of incoming sunlight back out to space. The most commonly discussed method is called stratospheric aerosol injection, which would involve spraying reflective particles like sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere to mimic the cooling effect of a large volcanic eruption.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. I mean, the idea of us deliberately conducting a planetary scale experiment with our only atmosphere, when we can't possibly predict all the consequences, it just feels like the height of human arrogance. We've already made one huge mess by pumping carbon dioxide into the air. This sounds like a way to make another, potentially even worse, mess.
Your reaction, Maya, captures the essence of the controversy. The scientific community is extremely cautious. The report emphasizes that geoengineering is not a substitute for cutting emissions. It does not address the root cause of the problem, which is the greenhouse gas blanket, and it carries immense and poorly understood risks. it could potentially disrupt regional weather patterns, harm the ozone layer, and it creates a moral hazard by possibly reducing the incentive for us to do the hard work of decarbonizing our economies.
So it's seen as a last-ditch, break glass in case of emergency option, with huge potential side effects. Maya, your point about the arrogance of these high-tech ideas is well taken. And while we're discussing these futuristic and risky technologies, the report highlights a profound failure in a much more basic and immediate area, finance and justice for the people already suffering the consequences. Carter, can you explain what the report calls the adaptation finance gap?
This is one of the most sobering findings in the entire report. While much of the focus is on mitigation, which is cutting emissions, adaptation, which is preparing for the impacts of climate change, is equally critical, especially for the world's most vulnerable nations. The UNEP Adaptation Gap Report revealed a staggering shortfall in funding.
How big is the shortfall?
The report estimates that the annual adaptation finance needs of developing countries are somewhere between $215 billion and $387 billion. In stark contrast, the total international public finance that flowed to these countries for adaptation in 2021 was just $21 billion, which was actually a 15% decline from the year before. This means the actual needs are 10 to 18 times greater than the funds that are actually being provided, leaving the most vulnerable communities dangerously exposed and underprepared.
I understand the need is great, but why is this framed as a justice issue? Isn't every country ultimately responsible for protecting its own citizens and adapting to its own challenges?
That question gets to the very core of the UN climate negotiations. The entire process is built upon a foundational principle known as common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the concept is straightforward. It acknowledges that while all nations share a common responsibility to protect the global climate, the developed countries, which have been industrializing for over a century, bear a much greater historical responsibility for causing the problem in the first place. They also possess far greater financial and technological capabilities to address it.
So the idea that the polluter should pay. The ones who created the mess have a greater obligation to help clean it up and to help protect those who are most harmed by it.
Exactly. Climate justice frameworks articulate this through the concept of a double inequality. The very people and nations who have contributed the least to the emissions that cause climate change are the ones who are suffering the earliest and most severe consequences. Therefore, a just global response requires that the developed nations lead the way in making the deepest emissions cuts and that they provide substantial financial and technological support to help developing nations adapt to the impacts they did little to cause.
Carter, you were just explaining this core principle of climate justice, that the nations with the greatest historical responsibility for emissions also have the greatest capacity to help solve the problem.
Yes, and it builds on what Maya was saying. It got recognizing the profound unfairness, the double inequality that lies at the heart of the climate crisis. The people who are most harmed are the ones who did the least to cause the problem. Think about it, a farmer in the Sahel whose land is turning to desert, or a family in a low-lying island nation whose home is threatened by sea level rise. Their contribution to historical emissions is practically zero.
So what you're saying is, that farmer, whose crops are failing from a drought they had no part in creating, is right now paying a much, much higher price than someone in a wealthy country who has, you know, benefited from a century of industrial development powered by fossil fuels.
That is the injustice in a nutshell. And so, the framework for a just response is built on that understanding. It means developed nations have a moral and ethical obligation to lead with deep, rapid emissions cuts. And, crucially, it means they have an obligation to provide significant financial and technological support to help developing nations build clean economies and adapt to the impacts they are already facing.
I understand the moral argument, I do. But from a purely practical standpoint, it seems incredibly complicated. I mean, how far back do you go to assign this historical responsibility? Are you trying to calculate the emissions of the United Kingdom from the 1880s? It feels like an impossibly complex way to assign blame.
That's a fair point, Frank. And you know, it's less about calculating precise historical blame and more about acknowledging the reality of the present day. The framework is not about punishing past generations. It's about recognizing which nations today have the accumulated wealth, the technology, and the stable institutions, many of which were built on that history of fossil fuel development, to lead the global response. It moves the technology of war. Well, that is the heart of the debate. Many nations were deeply disappointed that the language wasn't stronger. The hope is that even that language signals a clear direction to the global economy. That same conference also established a global goal to triple renewable energy capacity and double the rate of energy efficiency improvements by 2030, which are very concrete targets.
And what about the most recent conference mentioned in the report, COP29?
That was dubbed the Finance COP. Its main job was to agree on a new climate finance goal to help developing nations. After very contentious negotiations, they agreed that developed countries should lead in mobilizing at least $300 billion per year by 2035 for developing nations. But again, many of those nations expressed deep disappointment, stating that this number falls far, far short of their estimated needs, which are in the trillions.
This seems to be a recurring theme of falling short. Let's shift from the policy to the other major part of the response, which is technology. Here, the report does seem to highlight one area as a significant success story, and that is the renewables revolution.
Yes, this has been the brightest spot of the last decade, without a doubt. We've seen an absolutely explosive growth of renewable energy technologies, especially solar panels and wind power. This was driven by incredible innovation and economies of scale, and it caused the costs of solar and wind to plummet. They are now the cheapest sources of new electricity generation in most of the world. To give you a sense of the scale, in 2023, the world added a record 473 gigawatts of new renewable capacity. The International Energy Agency even forecasts that this year, in 2025, renewables will overtake coal as the single largest source of global electricity.
That genuinely good news, and everyone loves seeing cheaper energy. But I noticed the report also says that we are still not on track to meet that COP28 goal of tripling renewable capacity by 2030. Why is that? If this technology is so cheap and effective, why aren't we just building it everywhere, all the time, as fast as we possibly can? What's the holdup?
It's a great question, Frank. The momentum is incredible, but the scale of the challenge is even bigger. To achieve that tripling goal, we would need to be adding, on average, around 1,050 gigawatts of new capacity every single year for the rest of the decade. That's more than double the record we just set in 2023. The barriers are no longer primarily about cost, they are about things like modernizing our electrical grids to handle this new type of energy, overcoming supply chain bottlenecks for components, and streamlining the permitting processes to get projects built faster. So even in this huge success story, there is a major gap between our current progress and the required pace of change.
So Carter, even our biggest technological success story, renewable energy, is facing a challenge of sheer scale and speed. The report points to another critical tool in the toolbox, something often called the first fuel, which is energy efficiency.
Now, this is something that just seems like pure common sense to me. Using less energy to get the same result, whether it's an efficient appliance or an insulated home, it saves people money on their bills, it reduces strain on the power grid, and it cuts emissions. It seems like the absolute lowest hanging fruit. Why aren't we talking about this constantly?
You are absolutely right, Frank. Improving energy efficiency is the cheapest and cleanest way to address our energy needs, which is why the COP28 goal to double the global average annual rate of energy efficiency improvements by 2030 is so critical. But the reality, as the report lays out, has been deeply disappointing.
How so? What does the data show?
After a brief speed up in 2022, which was mostly in response to the global energy crisis, the rate of global energy intensity improvement slowed way down to just 1% in both 2023 and 2024. To be on a pathway to net zero emissions, we need that rate to be averaging around 4% per year. So we are falling far short. The report effectively calls it a major and concerning policy failure on a global scale.
So if we're failing on the common sense goal of efficiency, what about the more high-tech solutions that promise to clean up our existing emissions? Carter, the report spends some time on carbon capture, utilization and storage, or CCUS.
Again, on the surface, this sounds like a pragmatic solution. For those really difficult industries that are hard to electrify, like making cement or steel, why not just build a system to capture the carbon dioxide before it ever gets into the atmosphere? It seems like a logical way to solve the problem without having to completely shut down these essential industries overnight.
And that is exactly how it is often presented, Frank, as a necessary solution for these hard-to-abate sectors. And there is a lot of momentum in terms of announcements. The report notes there are over 700 projects in various stages of development. However, it also points to a massive gap between those announcements and the operational reality.
What do you mean by that? A gap between announcements and reality?
As of early 2024, the total global operational capacity for capturing CO2 was just over 50 million tons per year. That is a tiny fraction of what has been announced or proposed for 2030. and critically, only 20% of that announced capacity had actually reached a final investment decision. This indicates that most of these projects are still just on the drawing board, they are not yet real. So deployment has consistently and significantly lagged behind the expectations and the promises.
You know, I have to wonder if there's a risk here, that this technology just becomes an excuse, a way for fossil fuel companies and heavy industries to continue polluting, under the promise that someday, in the future, they'll be able to clean it all up. It feels like it could be a dangerous distraction from the real work of actually cutting emissions at the source.
Speaking of potentially dangerous and controversial ideas, the report mentions that as the world falls further behind on emissions reductions, there is a growing, albeit highly contentious, interest in something called solar geoengineering. Carter, can you even begin to explain what that is?
I can try. It's also sometimes called solar radiation modification. This refers to a set of hypothetical technologies that are designed to cool the planet by reflecting a small fraction of incoming sunlight back out to space. The most commonly discussed method is called stratospheric aerosol injection, which would involve spraying reflective particles like sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere to mimic the cooling effect of a large volcanic eruption.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. I mean, the idea of us deliberately conducting a planetary scale experiment with our only atmosphere, when we can't possibly predict all the consequences, it just feels like the height of human arrogance. We've already made one huge mess by pumping carbon dioxide into the air. This sounds like a way to make another, potentially even worse, mess.
Your reaction, Maya, captures the essence of the controversy. The scientific community is extremely cautious. The report emphasizes that geoengineering is not a substitute for cutting emissions. It does not address the root cause of the problem, which is the greenhouse gas blanket, and it carries immense and poorly understood risks. It could potentially disrupt regional weather patterns, harm the ozone layer, and it creates a moral hazard by possibly reducing the incentive for us to do the hard work of decarbonizing our economies.
So it's seen as a last-ditch, break-glass-in-case-of-emergency option, with huge potential side effects. Maya, your point about the arrogance of these high-tech ideas is well taken. And while we're discussing these futuristic and risky technologies, the report highlights a profound failure in a much more basic and immediate area, finance and justice, for the people already suffering the consequences. Carter, can you explain what the report calls the adaptation finance gap?
This is one of the most sobering findings in the entire report. While much of the focus is on mitigation, which is cutting emissions, adaptation, which is preparing for the impacts of climate change, is equally critical, especially for the world's most vulnerable nations. The UNEP Adaptation Gap Report revealed a staggering shortfall in funding.
How big is the shortfall?
The report estimates that the annual adaptation finance needs of developing countries are somewhere between $215 billion and $387 billion. In stark contrast, the total international public finance that flowed to these countries for adaptation in 2021 was just $21 billion, which was actually a 15% decline from the year before. This means the actual needs are 10 to 18 times greater than the funds that are actually being provided, leaving the most vulnerable communities dangerously exposed and underprepared.
I understand the need is great, but why is this framed as a justice issue? Isn't every country ultimately responsible for protecting its own citizens and adapting to its own challenges?
That question gets to the very core of the UN climate negotiations. The entire process is built upon a foundational principle known as common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the concept is straightforward. It acknowledges that while all nations share a common responsibility to protect the global climate, the developed countries, which have been industrializing for over a century, bear a much greater historical responsibility for causing the problem in the first place. They also possess far greater financial and technological capabilities to address it.
So it's the idea that the polluter should pay. The ones who created the mess have a greater obligation to help clean it up and to help protect those who are most harmed by it.
Exactly. Climate justice frameworks articulate this through the concept of a double inequality. The very people and nations who have contributed the least to the emissions that cause climate change are the ones who are suffering the earliest and most severe consequences. Therefore, a just global response requires that the developed nations lead the way in making the deepest emissions cuts and that they provide substantial financial and technological support to help developing nations adapt to the impacts they did little to cause.
Carter, you were just explaining this core principle of climate justice, that the nations with the greatest historical responsibility for emissions also have the greatest capacity to help solve the problem.
Yes, and it builds on what Maya was saying. It is about recognizing the profound unfairness, the double inequality that lies at the heart of the climate crisis. The people who are most harmed are the ones who did the least to cause the problem. Think about it, a farmer in the Sahel whose land is turning to desert, or a family in a low-lying island nation whose home is threatened by sea level rise. Their contribution to historical emissions is practically zero.
So what you're saying is, that farmer, whose crops are failing from a drought they had no part in creating, is right now paying a much, much higher price than someone in a wealthy country who has, you know, benefited from a century of industrial development powered by fossil fuels.
That is the injustice in a nutshell. And so, the framework for a just response is built on that understanding. It means developed nations have a moral and ethical obligation to lead with deep, rapid emissions cuts. And, crucially, it means they have an obligation to provide significant financial and technological support to help developing nations build clean economies and adapt to the impacts they are already facing.
I understand the moral argument. I do. But from a purely practical standpoint, it seems incredibly complicated. I mean, how far back do you go to assign this historical responsibility? Are you trying to calculate the emissions of the United Kingdom from the 1880s? It feels like an impossibly complex way to assign blame.
That's a fair point, Frank. And you know, it's less about calculating precise historical blame and more about acknowledging the reality of the present day. The framework is not about punishing past generations. It's about recognizing which nations today have the accumulated wealth, the technology, and the stable institutions, many of which were built on that history of fossil fuel development, to lead the global response. It about capability and responsibility in the here and now.
This whole conversation about justice, responsibility, and the immense shortfall in support really underscores the urgency of the crisis. And perhaps nothing in this entire report highlights that urgency more than the growing scientific understanding of a concept known as climate tipping points. Carter, for our listeners, what exactly is a tipping point?
It is probably the most sobering concept in all of climate science. The IPCC defines a tipping point as a critical threshold in the Earth's system. Once that threshold is crossed, a part of the system could trigger an abrupt, cascading, and potentially irreversible change.
Abrupt and irreversible, those are two very powerful words. What does irreversible mean in this context?
It means that even if we manage to cool the planet back down later, the system might not flip back. The change could be locked in for centuries or even millennia. We could pass a point of no return.
That is a terrifying thought. So what are these systems? What parts of the planet are we talking about?
Scientists have identified several large-scale components of the Earth's system that may have these tipping points. The most commonly discussed are the Great Ice Sheets. We're talking about the irreversible collapse of the Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheets.
And what would be the consequence of something like that?
Well, together, those two ice sheets hold enough frozen water to raise the global mean sea level by over 10 meters. That's about 33 feet.
10 meters. I can't even comprehend that. That's not just flooding. That is wiping entire cities, entire island nations, completely off the map for good.
Yes, the consequences would be civilization-altering. And another major tipping element is in the oceans themselves. A major slowdown or even a shutdown of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, often called the AMOC.
The AMOC? I've heard of that, but it sounds like something out of a disaster movie. What does this current actually do for us?
It's a massive system of ocean currents that acts like a conveyor belt, transporting warm water from the tropics up to the North Atlantic. It plays a huge role in regulating weather patterns, especially in the northern hemisphere. A collapse of this system would drastically alter weather across North America and Europe, causing, you know, extreme cooling in some places, changing rainfall patterns, and disrupting monsoons that billions of people depend on for their food.
So we have the ice and the oceans. What else?
Then we have the biosphere systems. There are two major ones scientists are deeply concerned about. The first is the potential dieback of the Amazon rainforest.
So the Amazon could go from being this vital carbon sink that helps us to becoming a major carbon source that actually hurts us?
Precisely. Large parts of the forest could transition into a drier savanna-like ecosystem. And in doing so, it would release the vast quantities of carbon stored in its trees and soil, which would create a powerful feedback loop that accelerates even more global warming.
And the other one, you hear people talk about a ticking carbon bomb in the Arctic. Is that what you mean?
That's the one. The abrupt, widespread thawing of permafrost. This is the permanently frozen ground in the Arctic regions, and it contains enormous amounts of organic carbon that has been locked away for thousands of years. As it thaws, microbes decompose that organic matter and release it into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and, even more potently, methane. This is another one of those dangerous feedback loops.
So, Carter, we have these massive continent-scale systems that could fundamentally break. I think for a long time, many of us thought of these tipping points as very distant risks. You know, things that might happen if warming got really, really bad, say at 5 or 6 degrees Celsius. What does the latest science in the report say about that?
This, Alice, is perhaps the single most concerning finding to emerge in the last few years of research. The scientific consensus has shifted. Those early estimates that suggested these were high warming risks have been revised. The latest research, which is cited in the IPCC reports, indicates that the temperature thresholds for triggering some of these tipping points may be much, much lower than we previously thought.
How much lower are we talking about?
The latest studies indicate that several of these major tipping points, including the collapse of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, the shutdown of the AMOC, and widespread permafrost thaw, could potentially be triggered at warming levels between 1.5 and 2.0 degrees Celsius.
But wait a minute. Carter, you said at the very, very beginning of our conversation that the world already temporarily breached 1.5 degrees of warming in 2024. If the trigger point is 1.5 degrees, what does that mean for us right now?
It means... Well, it means that the risk is no longer a distant abstract threat for future generations. It places the possibility of crossing these irreversible thresholds squarely within the realm of possibility this century. It moves the conversation from the future into the immediate present. It adds a profound, almost existential urgency to the need for immediate, deep, and drastic emissions reductions. The window of opportunity to steer away from these points is closing, and it is closing very, very rapidly.
That is a deeply unsettling reality to confront, Carter. And Maya, I see you reacting to that. When you hear that the 1.5 degree line, which we've talked about for so long as this future guardrail, is not only something we've touched, but is also the potential trigger for these irreversible changes, what does that feel like?
You know, it almost takes your breath away. It feels like we've been driving towards a cliff in the fog, arguing about how fast we should be going. And Carter is saying the fog has just cleared, and we're right at the edge. We're there. That's a very, very hard thing to fully process.
It is, and it brings up a really difficult practical question for me. If we're already on the verge of crossing these irreversible thresholds, what is the point of all this? I mean, does a 43% emissions cut by 2030, which already seems impossible, even matter anymore if the fuse has already been lit on something like the Greenland ice sheet? Have we already lost the game?
Frank, that is the most important question anyone can ask right now. And the conclusion of the report argues that this is precisely why our actions now matter more than they ever have before. The first major conclusion is that the defining characteristic of the last decade is nonlinear acceleration.
Okay, nonlinear acceleration. Break that down for us.
Think of it like a car that's rolling down a hill. But the hill isn't a steady slope, it's a curve that gets steeper and steeper as you go. So for every foot you travel, your speed increases more than it did in the previous foot. You are accelerating exponentially. Not in a straight line, not arithmetically, that what happening to our planetary systems. The risks are growing at an accelerating rate.
So every fraction of a degree of warming we can prevent now, every year we can act faster, has a much bigger impact in preventing that future acceleration than it would have 20 or 30 years ago.
Exactly. It Bill Sullard...
What scientists call positive feedback loops becoming more potent.
So, to answer Frank's question, it's the absolute opposite of the game being lost. It means the stakes of our actions in the next 5 to 10 years are higher than they have ever been in human history. Every ton of carbon we keep out of the atmosphere now pays huge dividends in slowing down that terrifying acceleration toward those tipping points.
And the report also concludes that these are not isolated problems, correct? It talks about a cascade of interconnected crises.
Yes, that's the second key takeaway. We can no longer think of climate impacts as a series of separate events. A drought is not just a lack of water, it is a trigger. It triggers failures in the food system when crops fail. It triggers failures in the economic system when farmers lose their livelihoods. It triggers, you know, public health crises from malnutrition and waterborne diseases. It can even culminate in social instability and displacement. Climate change is a threat multiplier that makes all our existing vulnerabilities worse.
You can really see that in real life, can't you? I mean, a wildfire isn't just a fire anymore. It becomes a public health crisis for millions of people breathing in the smoke. It's an economic crisis for the entire region. It becomes a water crisis months later when the first heavy rains wash toxic ash and debris into the reservoirs. You realize that one event pulls on all the other threads that hold our society together. Everything is connected.
That's a perfect way to put it, Maya. And because everything is connected, the report concludes that our response has to be holistic. We can't have siloed policies that address energy or agriculture or public health in isolation. They are all part of the same interconnected challenge.
This brings us to the third and perhaps the toughest conclusion from the report, which is that our global response, as it stands today, is being dangerously outpaced by the physical reality of climate change.
That's the hard truth of the last decade. Despite all the meetings and the progress on renewables, the response remains critically insufficient. The report concludes that this failure is defined by three persistent and widening gaps. First is the ambition gap we already discussed, the gap between the weak climate pledges from countries and what science clearly shows is necessary.
And the second?
The second is the adaptation finance gap, which we just covered. The massive shortfall in funding that leaves the world's most vulnerable populations essentially undefended against the coming storms and droughts. And the third is the justice gap, which undermines the trust and cooperation that are absolutely essential for any kind of effective global solution.
So if I'm hearing this correctly, the report estimate conclusion is that our primary problem is no longer a technological one. We have the solar panels, we have the wind turbines, we have the efficiency solutions. The report is saying that the biggest barriers now are political, financial, and social. It's about a lack of political will, a failure to mobilize the necessary funds, and a failure to address the core injustices of the crisis.
That is the absolute crux of the conclusion. Technology is a vital tool, an essential tool, but it is not a silver bullet. The primary obstacles are now in our halls of government, in our financial institutions, and in our collective willingness to face this reality and act at the scale it requires.
So after this incredibly detailed and frankly alarming look back at the last decade, where does this leave us? We have a planet in a state of acceleration. We've temporarily breached the 1.5 degree threshold, and the risk of irreversible tipping points is no longer a future problem, but a present-day danger. Maya, I want to start with you. What's your final takeaway?
It leaves me feeling that the time for simply being worried or for abstract hope is over. The only appropriate response to this level of evidence is determined action. This report is a story written in data, and it's telling us we have to transform this stark awareness into real, tangible work in our communities and demand it from our leaders. There's no time for anything else.
Frank?
It leaves me thinking that we need to have a much more honest and pragmatic conversation about the real-world costs and trade-offs. We've talked about technology and policy, but this report makes it clear that the real fight is over politics and economics. And until we tackle that head-on, with honesty, we'll keep falling short.
And Carter, a final thought from you.
The science has been clear for a long time, but the evidence from this past decade is definitive. You know, this period from 2015 to 2025 will be remembered as the decade the consequences of our inaction became undeniable. That temporary breach of 1.5 degrees served as a final, unambiguous warning. The scientific challenge now is to monitor these accelerating changes. But the human challenge is to finally close those gaps between promises and performance before those tipping points are crossed for good.
Carter, that is a powerful and frankly stark place to end, on the precipice of these tipping points with the clock running out. But, you know, before we wrap up completely, I want to hold on that last thought, the human challenge. I feel we can't end just with the warning. I want to pivot from the problems we've detailed so thoroughly to the specific pathways forward that are emerging. Beyond the high-level policy failures, where are the new fronts in this challenge?
That's a crucial pivot to make, Alice, because despair is paralyzing. And despite the failures, there are new strategies and, you know, new arenas of action that are gaining momentum.
Let's talk about one of those. We've mentioned the justice gap and the economic challenges. What about the people, the workers and communities, whose entire livelihoods are tied to the fossil fuel industries we need to transition away from?
You're talking about the concept of a just transition. And you know, this has become a central part of the conversation because it's both morally right and politically essential. A just transition means ensuring that the shift to a green economy is fair and inclusive. It means we don't leave coal miners, oil rig workers, and entire communities that depend on these industries behind.
This is something I think is critical. You can't just tell millions of people that their jobs, their skills, their histories are obsolete without a concrete plan. You know, you'd have massive social and political unrest. For people to buy into this massive economic shift, they have to see a future for themselves in it. A real plan for retraining, for new jobs in clean energy manufacturing or grid modernization, That is absolutely essential.
And it's more than just jobs, isn't it? It's about identity and community. For generations, some towns have been defined by the local power plant or the mine. A just transition means investing in those places, helping them to diversify and build a new economic foundation that honors their heritage, but, you know, allows them to thrive in a different kind of future. It's about respecting people while we make these big changes.
So ensuring the transition is fair is one emerging pathway. Maya, you just mentioned respecting people and their heritage. What about respecting nature itself? The report touched on biodiversity. Are we starting to see a move towards working with nature to solve this?
I hope so, because for so long it feels like we've been trying to invent some new machine to fix the problems our last machine created. It just seems so obvious that we should be looking to nature, which has been regulating the climate for millions of years, for solutions.
And that intuition is now a major field of action called nature-based solutions. The idea is to use the power of healthy ecosystems to help us. And you know, the benefits are often twofold. For example, restoring coastal mangrove forests. Mangroves are incredible at absorbing carbon, but they also act as a natural seawall, protecting coastal communities from storm surges far more effectively and cheaply than a concrete barrier.
So it helps with both mitigation, by absorbing carbon, and adaptation, by providing protection.
Exactly. And there are many other examples. Reforestation and afforestation, planting trees to draw down carbon from the atmosphere. Regenerative agriculture, which involves farming practices that restore the health of the soil, turning it back into a powerful carbon sink. These solutions don't just fight climate change, they also restore biodiversity, they clean our water, and they can make our food systems more resilient.
So much of the report focused on the failures of national governments to act, but we know a lot of the real-world changes happen at a more local level. What about the role of cities and even large corporations? Are they stepping up to fill the leadership vacuum?
In many cases, yes. Cities are often more agile and pragmatic than national governments. Networks like the C4 Cities Climate Leadership Group are hubs of innovation. You know, cities are where you see real progress on electrifying public transport, creating greener buildings, and improving waste management, all of which have a huge impact on emissions.
That makes sense. But what about the private sector? We hear every major company in the world announcing some kind of a net zero by 2050 target. How much of that is real, tangible action, and how much of it is just good public relations? You know, just greenwashing? Is anyone actually holding them accountable for these promises?
That is the billion-dollar question, Frank. And you're right to be skeptical. The last few years have seen a surge in these pledges, but there's also been a surge in scrutiny. There is a huge push now to move companies beyond vague promises towards transparent, science-based targets for the near term. We're seeing a real divide emerge between the companies that are genuinely transforming their business models and those that are, frankly, just trying to improve their image. Accountability is still a massive work in progress.
So if governments are slow and corporations can't always be trusted, what other avenues for accountability are emerging? Where else are people pushing for change?
One of the most dynamic and, you know, potentially powerful new fronts is in the courtroom. We are seeing a huge increase in what is called climate litigation.
So people are actually suing governments and companies over climate change?
Yes, all over the world. Citizens, activist groups, cities, and even states are taking national governments to court to force them to adopt stronger climate policies, arguing that inaction violates their fundamental human rights to a healthy environment. And, connecting back to our earlier conversation, they are also suing the major fossil fuel companies. They are using that attribution science we discussed to directly link the emissions from a company's products to the specific harms and financial damages their communities have suffered from floods, wildfires, and sea level rise. It's a new and rapidly evolving way to demand accountability.
And Carter, that's a fascinating development, the idea that a courtroom could become a key battleground for climate action. Frank, you look skeptical.
Well, I am. I mean, it sounds good in a headline, activists sue oil giant. But do these lawsuits actually work? It seems like they would get tied up in court for decades with armies of corporate lawyers. Can a lawsuit really change the course of a multi-trillion dollar global industry?
It's a valid skepticism, Frank. And you're right, it's not a quick fix. But the impact isn't just about winning a single huge payout. These cases create enormous pressure. They force companies to disclose internal documents, they generate negative publicity, and you know, they establish a legal record of responsibility. It fundamentally changes the risk calculation for these industries and their investors.
And it changes the story, doesn't it? It reframes this from being a sort of blameless collective problem to one of specific, attributable harm. It says you knew about the damage your product would cause and you did it anyway. That's a powerful narrative.
So beyond the courtroom, what other economic tools are being discussed to drive this transition? The report mentions things like carbon pricing. Carter, what does that actually mean?
Carbon pricing is a very direct economic strategy. It's about putting a price on carbon pollution to discourage its use. There are two main ways to do it. You can have a straightforward carbon tax, where the government sets a price per ton of carbon emitted. Or you can have a cap and trade system, where the government sets a limit, a cap, on total emissions and then allows companies to buy and sell permits to emit.
Okay, but let's be honest about what that means. A carbon tax just gets passed on to the consumer, right? It means higher gas prices, higher heating bills. It seems like a policy that would disproportionately hurt lower-income families and working people, while the big corporations just factor it into the cost of doing business.
That is the single biggest and most important concern with carbon pricing, Frank. And if it's designed poorly, that's exactly what can happen. However, a well-designed system can actually be equitable. For example, some proposals are for a carbon fee and dividend system.
A dividend? So you get money back?
Exactly. The revenue collected from the carbon tax isn't just kept by the government. It's returned directly to citizens on an equal per-person basis. In that system, most lower- and middle-income families would actually come out ahead. They would get more back in the dividend than they pay in higher energy costs, because wealthier people tend to have a much larger carbon footprint.
You know, it's also about what costs we're already paying. We don't see a line item on our bills for it, but we are all paying the price for pollution right now. We pay it in healthcare costs from asthma and other respiratory diseases linked to burning fossil fuels. We pay it in disaster recovery funds when our taxes go to rebuilding a town after a flood. A carbon price isn't creating a new cost, it's just making a hidden cost visible.
This brings us to a question I think is on everyone's mind. We've talked about these huge complex systems, from international law to national energy policy. It can all feel very distant. So what about us? What about individual action versus systemic change? Maya, does it really make a difference if I diligently sort my recycling or eat less meat when the scale of the problem is this vast?
That is the question, isn't it? And it's so easy to feel like your small actions are just a drop in an angry ocean. But I truly believe they matter, just maybe not in the way we think. You know, the direct impact of me not using a plastic straw isn't going to stop the West Antarctic ice sheet from collapsing. I get that, but that's not the only point.
So what is the point, from your perspective?
When we make these conscious choices, we're not just reducing our own tiny footprint. We are sending signals. We are sending a signal to the market that there's demand for sustainable products. We are sending a signal to our friends and neighbors that this is something we care about, which helps to normalize climate consciousness in our culture.
And you know, most importantly, we are sending a signal to politicians that we are a constituency that will support bold climate action.
Oh, shitty.
Our individual actions build the social and political momentum for the big systemic changes to happen.
I think Maya's point is absolutely crucial. The two are not in opposition, they reinforce each other. You need both. Individual action alone is not sufficient, that's clear. We cannot solve this crisis by changing light bulbs and bringing reusable bags to the grocery store. We absolutely need the large-scale government policies and corporate transformations that will decarbonize our entire energy grid and industrial base.
Right, because asking an individual to solve climate change is like asking a soldier to win a war by themselves. It's an unfair burden.
Exactly. But at the same time, systemic change is not something that just happens in a vacuum. It is the result of millions of people demanding it. So individual action is the necessary foundation. It's the engine of cultural change that makes the politics of systemic change possible. They are two sides of the very same coin. One cannot succeed without the other.
That's a really helpful way to frame it, Carter. So our individual choices create the culture, and that culture creates the political will for systemic change. Let's look forward then, as we chart a course out of this crisis. What are some of the other major technological or social shifts we need to be thinking about? The report's appendix lists 100 different topics, one of which is the future of food.
Yes, and this is absolutely critical. Because, as we discussed, agriculture is a major source of emissions. The future of food really involves a two-pronged approach. First, on the production side, it means scaling up what's often called sustainable or regenerative agriculture. These are farming practices that can reduce emissions, improve soil health so it absorbs more carbon, and use less water.
And what's the second part? It has to be about what we eat, right?
It is. It also involves changes in diet, particularly in wealthy nations. The science is quite clear that a diet lower in red meat consumption and higher in plant-based foods has a significantly smaller environmental footprint. This doesn't mean everyone has to become a vegetarian, but a societal shift in that direction would have a huge impact.
Now, this is where it gets tricky for me. You start talking about what people eat, and it feels like a massive overreach. People's diets are incredibly personal and cultural. Are we really going to tell people they can't have a burger? That feels like a political non-starter, and it plays right into the hands of those who say climate action is about sacrifice and a lower quality of life.
I hear that, Frank. I really do. But maybe the framing isn't about sacrifice. Maybe it's about health and choice and innovation. You know, the incredible boom in really high-quality, tasty plant-based alternatives is a market-driven solution. It's not about forcing anyone to do anything. It's about providing better options that are good for people and good for the planet. It's a cultural shift, not a government mandate.
So food is one area. What about on the energy side? We've talked a lot about renewables, but there's another powerful and often controversial source of carbon-free electricity mentioned in the report, nuclear power. Carter, where does that fit into the picture?
Well, nuclear power is complicated. On the one hand, it is a proven, reliable 24/7 source of zero-emission electricity. And from a purely climate perspective, many scientists and energy experts argue that it has to be part of the solution, especially for providing a stable baseload of power when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing.
It seems like a no-brainer to me. If the goal is to eliminate carbon emissions from electricity as fast as possible, why aren't we building advanced nuclear reactors everywhere? The safety concerns, from what I've read about the newer designs, are vastly different from the older plants people think of.
But the legacy is still there, isn't it? For so many people, the word nuclear brings up images of Chernobyl or Fukushima. And even if the new plants are safer, you still have the problem of nuclear waste. What do we do with this material that remains dangerously radioactive for thousands of years?
It feels like we're solving one problem for ourselves by creating a potentially massive one for countless generations to come.
And that, Maya, is the core of the dilemma. The issues of waste disposal, public perception, high upfront costs, and long construction times have made nuclear a very difficult path to pursue politically, even if the technology itself has advanced. It remains one of the most contentious and unresolved debates in the energy transition.
This debate over nuclear power really highlights that the energy transition isn't just a scientific or economic challenge, it's also a geopolitical one. Carter, how is this massive global shift from fossil fuels to clean energy changing the relationships between countries?
It's changing everything. For a century, geopolitics has been shaped by who has the oil and gas. But in a world powered by renewables, the map of power changes. It shifts from countries with fossil fuel reserves to countries that lead in manufacturing solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries. It also shifts power to countries that have the critical mineral resources like lithium, cobalt, and copper that are essential for these technologies.
So we're just trading a dependency on oil from the Middle East for a dependency on batteries and minerals from other parts of the world? It sounds like we're just swapping one set of geopolitical problems for another.
That is a very real risk, and it's a major concern. Creating more resilient and diversified supply chains for these technologies is a huge priority. But there's also an upside. The resources for renewable energy, you know, sunlight and wind, are far more democratically distributed around the globe than fossil fuels are. Almost every country has the potential to generate its own clean energy, which could lead to greater energy independence and a more stable world in the long run.
So after this incredibly comprehensive discussion, from the accelerating science to the cascading impacts and the immense challenges in our global response, I want to bring it back to a final thought from each of you. We're standing at the end of this decade of consequence. The report makes it clear the window is closing. Where do we go from here? Frank?
For me, it comes down to honesty. I think we need to be more honest about the scale of the challenge and the true costs and trade-offs of the transition. We can't pretend this will be easy or painless, but if we can have a pragmatic conversation that acknowledges the difficulties, I think we have a better chance of bringing everyone along and actually getting it done.
Maya, a final thought from you.
I keep coming back to that idea of connection. This report shows how everything is connected. The ice melting in the Arctic is connected to the flood in your town, is connected to the food on your plate. And if the problem is one of broken connections, then the solution has to be about rebuilding them. Reconnecting with nature, reconnecting with our communities, and, you know, finding a shared sense of purpose to protect our common home. For me, the way forward has to be rooted in that sense of shared humanity.
Thank you, Frank and Maya. That's a powerful call for honesty and for rebuilding our connections. Carter, I want to give you the final word on this part of our discussion. After laying out all this evidence, what is the single most important message you think we should take away about the path forward?
I think the message is that the era of excuses is over. For decades, you could argue that we didn't fully understand, or that the technology wasn't ready, or that the impacts felt distant. This report from 2015 to 2025 slams the door on all of that. We know with painful certainty what is happening. We have the technological solutions like solar and wind that are not only ready but are now cheaper than the alternative. And the impacts are no longer distant, they are here, causing billions in damages and immense human suffering every single year.
So the barriers are no longer technical or scientific?
Not primarily. The report's inescapable conclusion is that the greatest barrier is a lack of political will, fueled by inertia and, you know, the vested interests of the fossil fuel industry. Overcoming that political barrier is now the central challenge. The road ahead, the road to the next major climate conference, COP30, and beyond, is not about inventing a new machine. It's about building a global consensus for action that is so powerful it becomes politically unstoppable.
Carter, you say that building a global consensus, but you know, I look at the world and our politics seem more fractured and nationalistic than ever. How on earth do we create this unstoppable global movement when major countries can barely agree on basic trade rules, let alone something that requires a complete re-engineering of our entire economy? It feels, well, it feels naive.
It's not naive to see the immense difficulty, Frank. It is, perhaps the hardest thing humanity has ever tried to do. But it's not without precedent. We have faced global threats before. You know, scientists in the 1980s discovered that certain chemicals were destroying the ozone layer. The world came together, listened to the science, and passed the Montreal Protocol to phase out those chemicals, and it worked. The ozone layer is healing.
But is that a fair comparison? Banning a few chemicals used in spray cans and refrigerators seems so much simpler than replacing the entire energy source that powers our civilization.
Oh, you are absolutely right, Maya. The climate challenge is orders of magnitude more complex and more difficult. But the principle is the same. Science identified a threat and international cooperation solved it. What's different now, and you know, what gives me a sliver of hope, is that the threat is no longer an invisible hole in the sky. The escalating costs of floods, droughts, and fires are becoming so painfully obvious that the political calculation for leaders is starting to change. Inaction is becoming more politically expensive than action.
And maybe the consensus doesn't just come from those leaders in a conference room. You know, I think about the youth climate movement. When millions of young people around the world take to the streets, inspired by activists like Greta Thunberg, that creates a different kind of pressure. It's a moral pressure. It builds from the ground up and forces its way into the halls of power. It's a reminder that this isn't just about economics, it's about their future that's being negotiated away.
That's a powerful point, Maya. The role of that moral pressure from the next generation. And it brings up the stark reality of what is truly at stake here. Carter, when we talk about these long-term consequences, like sea level rise, the report makes it clear these are not temporary problems that will just go away if we fix our emissions. It talks about impacts being locked in for centuries. Can you explain that long-term legacy?
Yes, and this is a concept that is difficult to grasp but absolutely crucial. The Earth's climate system has enormous inertia. Think of the oceans like a giant flywheel. They have absorbed over 90% of the excess heat we've trapped, and it takes a very, very long time for that heat to dissipate. Likewise, carbon dioxide is a very long-lived gas. Much of what we emit today will still be in the atmosphere, warming the planet hundreds of years from now.
So what does that mean in practical terms? Let's say, hypothetically, we wave a magic wand and stop all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, globally. Zero emissions. Does the warming stop? Do sea levels stop rising?
No. And that is the hard reality. Even in that magical scenario, the planet would continue to warm for some time, and sea levels would continue to rise for centuries, possibly for millennia. The heat that is already stored in the deep ocean would continue to circulate and warm the surface. The existing greenhouse gases would continue to trap heat. The amount of warming and sea level rise we've already experienced is in many ways a done deal. That is the legacy we have already written.
So even in the best-case scenario, things will still get worse before they get better.
For a time, yes. But it's vital we don't interpret that as our efforts being futile. It is the absolute opposite. The actions we take in this decade will determine how much worse things get and for how long. We are at the controls, making a choice right now between a future where sea levels rise by, say, another meter, which is devastating but perhaps manageable, and a future where they rise by 10 meters, which would be an unimaginable catastrophe. We are deciding today what percentage of the world's species will go extinct. We are deciding how much of the planet will become uninhabitable for our own grandchildren. We are locking in that future with the choices we make today.
That is an incredibly powerful and sobering thought, Carter. The idea that we are right now writing the legacy for centuries to come. You know, it raises a profound psychological question. How do we live with that knowledge? How do we confront this reality of a locked-in future without falling into paralysis or, you know, just complete despair?
That's the question I grapple with every day, Alice. And I know so many others do, too. There what a real grief in realizing what we've already lost and a real fear for what to come. And some days that can feel completely overwhelming. But you know what I've found for myself is that the only real antidote to that anxiety is action.
Action. That easy to say. But if the problem is this big and some of the damage is already done, what does that action even look like? It can feel like, I don't know, bailing out a sinking ship with a teaspoon. It might make you feel better, but is it actually changing the outcome? I worry about climate fatigue. People just get so overwhelmed by the bad news that they tune it all out.
I see what you mean, Frank. I really do. But maybe the teaspoon isn't the point. Maybe the point is that when you start bailing, the person next to you sees you and picks up their own teaspoon. And then another person does. The action itself builds a sense of community and shared purpose. It's about building what some people call active hope. It's not a blind optimism that everything will be fine. It's a belief that if we work together, we can still create a better outcome than the one we're heading for. And that work, that action, gives us a sense of agency in a situation that can feel hopeless.
I think that a crucial insight, Maya. And Frank, to address your point about fatigue, part of the solution is to change the narrative from one of pure sacrifice to one of opportunity. And there's real data to back this up. You know, the transition to a clean economy isn't just about shutting things down, it's about building new things. The International Energy Agency has reported that jobs in the clean energy sector are growing rapidly around the world, outpacing the fossil fuel industry.
So this connects back to what we discussed earlier, the idea of a just transition. It's what creating tangible, positive, real-world opportunities for people.
Precisely. It's about showing people a vision of the future that is not just survivable, but actually better. A future with cleaner air, quieter cities, and new well-paying jobs in industries like solar installation, battery manufacturing, and grid modernization. When people can see a concrete benefit for themselves and their communities, it's a very powerful motivator. It helps to overcome that sense of fatigue and shifts the focus to building a future we actually want.
So as we talk about building this new future, let's dive into another one of the advanced technologies mentioned in the report's appendix. We hear a lot of buzz about it. Carter, can you tell us about green hydrogen? What is it and what role is it supposed to play?
Of course. In simple terms, green hydrogen is a way to store clean energy. You take electricity from a renewable source, like a solar or wind farm, and you use it to power a machine called an electrolyzer. And this machine splits water, which is H2O, into its basic components, hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen that you get from this process is a clean, carbon-free fuel.
Okay, so it's a clean fuel. But Carter, I've heard there are major problems with it. For one, it's incredibly inefficient, isn't it? You use a huge amount of electricity to make the hydrogen, and then you lose more energy when you convert it back into power. And the cost, it seems to be way more expensive than just using the electricity directly. It sounds like another one of those futuristic solutions that's always just over the horizon.
Those are absolutely the key challenges, Frank. You are right, there are energy losses in the process, and right now the cost of producing green hydrogen is still high compared to other options. However, the costs are falling rapidly as the technology scales up, much like we saw with solar panels a decade ago. And its real potential isn't necessarily for powering cars or homes, where batteries are often a better fit.
So where does it fit? What's the specific job for this tool?
Its promise is in those hard-to-abate sectors that we keep coming back to. Think about heavy industries like steel and cement manufacturing, which require incredibly high heat that's hard to achieve with just electricity. Or long-haul transportation like container ships and airplanes. For these sectors, a clean-burning fuel like green hydrogen could be a genuine game-changer, a way to decarbonize parts of our economy that batteries can't easily reach.
You know, hearing this, it highlights something I think is really confusing for a lot of people. It feels like every year there are new savior technology. First it was biofuels, then it was clean coal, now it's hydrogen. It's and it can start to feel like we're just hoping for some single magic bullet to come along and fix everything for us. Maybe that's the wrong way to look at it.
Maya, that is an incredibly wise observation. And you are absolutely right. The search for a single magic bullet has been a distraction. The most useful analogy is to think of it as a toolbox. You would never try to build a house with only a hammer. You need a saw, a screwdriver, a wrench, all for different tasks.
Oh, I see. So it's not about hydrogen versus batteries, or renewables versus nuclear.
Exactly. It's about having all of them in the toolbox. We need renewables to generate the clean electricity. We need batteries for short-term storage and for electric vehicles. We need green hydrogen for those specific industrial and transport applications. We need to massively ramp up energy efficiency to reduce overall demand. The goal isn't to find the one perfect solution, it's to build a resilient, robust, and flexible system using all the different tools that we have.
That's a really helpful way to frame it, Carter. A whole toolbox, not a magic wand. But you know, when you talk about all these huge complex systems, from green hydrogen infrastructure to nuclear power plants, it can all feel very distant and overwhelming for the average person. Which brings us to a question I think is on everyone's mind. What about us? What about individual action versus systemic change? Maya, does it really make a difference if I diligently sort my recycling or eat less meat when the scale of the problem is this vast?
That is the question, isn't it? And it's so easy to feel like your small actions are just a drop in an angry ocean. But I truly believe they matter, just maybe not in the way we usually think. You know, the direct carbon impact of me not using a plastic straw isn't going to stop the West Antarctic ice sheet from collapsing. I get that, but that's not the only point. But isn't it the most important point? I mean, we can all feel good about our reusable coffee cups, but meanwhile, a single coal plant is wiping out all our collective efforts in a matter of minutes. It feels like a distraction. It shifts the burden of responsibility from the handful of massive corporations and governments causing the problem onto the shoulders of billions of individuals. It feels unfair.
I see that, Frank, and that's a real danger. But when we make these conscious choices, we're doing more than just reducing our own tiny footprint. We are sending signals. We send a signal to the market that there's demand for sustainable products. We send a signal to our friends and neighbors that this is something we care about, which, you know, helps to normalize climate consciousness in our culture. And most importantly, we send a signal to politicians that we are a constituency that will support bold climate action. Our individual actions build the social and political momentum for the big systemic changes to happen.
I think Maya's point is absolutely crucial, and Frank's concern is equally valid. The two ideas are not in opposition, they actually reinforce each other. You need both. Individual action alone is not sufficient, that's clear. We cannot solve this crisis by changing light bulbs. We absolutely need the large-scale government policies and corporate transformations that will decarbonize our entire industrial base.
So it's not a choice between one or the other?
Not at all. But at the same time, that systemic change doesn't just happen in a vacuum. It is the result of millions of people demanding it. So individual action is the necessary foundation. It's the engine of cultural change that makes the politics of systemic change possible. They are two sides of the very same coin. One cannot succeed without the other.
That's a great way to put it. So if individual action helps create the political will for systemic change, let's talk about one of the most powerful systemic tools that economists often discuss. Carter, the report mentions carbon pricing and emissions trading systems. Can you explain what that is?
Certainly. Carbon pricing is a very direct economic strategy. It's about putting a price on carbon pollution to discourage it. There are two main ways to do it. You can have a straightforward carbon tax, where the government sets a price per ton of carbon dioxide emitted. Or you can have what's called a cap-and-trade system.
And how does cap-and-trade work?
In that system, the government sets a limit, a cap, on the total amount of emissions allowed in a sector, say, the electricity sector. And that cap gets lower every year. Then, companies within that sector are given permits to pollute, or they have to buy them. If a company pollutes less than its permit allows, it can sell its leftover permits to a company that pollutes more. This creates a financial incentive to cut emissions as cheaply as possible.
Okay, but let's be honest about what a carbon tax really means for the average person. It just gets passed on to the consumer, right? It means higher prices at the gas pump, higher home heating bills. It seems like a policy that would disproportionately hurt lower-income families and working people who spend a much bigger chunk of their income on those essentials. It sounds deeply unfair.
That is the single biggest and most important concern with carbon pricing, Frank. And if it's designed poorly, that's exactly what can happen. It can be regressive. However, a well-designed system can actually address this and be equitable. For example, some of the most popular proposals are for a carbon fee and dividend system.
A dividend? So you're saying people would get money back?
Exactly. The revenue collected from the carbon tax isn't just kept by the government to spend on other things. It's returned directly to every citizen on an equal per person basis, like a check in the mail or a direct deposit. In that system, most lower and middle income families would actually come out ahead. They would get more back in the dividend than they pay in higher energy costs, simply because wealthier people tend to travel more, have larger homes, and have a much larger carbon footprint.
You know, it's also about what costs we're already paying. We don't see a line item on our bills for it, but we are all paying the price for pollution right now. We pay it in healthcare costs from asthma and other respiratory diseases linked to burning fossil fuels.
We pay it in our insurance premiums, which go up after every climate-fueled disaster. We pay it in our taxes, which go to rebuilding a town after a flood. A carbon price isn't creating a new cost, it's just making a hidden cost visible and putting it on the people who are creating the pollution.
That a powerful reframe, Maya. Shifting our perspective from a new tax to making a hidden cost visible. This conversation about fairness and who pays the cost brings us to another critical justice issue the report touches on. The impact on the workers and communities whose entire economies are built on the old system. Carter, can you talk about the concept of a just transition?
Yes, and you know, this has moved from the fringes of the discussion to the absolute center, because it's both morally right and frankly politically essential. A just transition means ensuring that the massive shift to a green economy is fair and inclusive. It means we don't leave coal miners, oil rig workers, and entire communities that depend on these industries behind.
This is something I think is absolutely critical, and it's often glossed over. You can't just tell millions of people that their jobs, their skills, their entire community's history is obsolete without a concrete funded plan. If you do, you get massive social and political unrest. For people to buy into this huge economic shift, they have to see a future for themselves in it. A real plan for retraining, for new jobs in clean energy manufacturing or grid modernization, that is absolutely essential. And it's more than just a paycheck, isn't it? It's about identity and community. For generations, some towns have been defined by the local power plant or the mine. That's a source of pride. A just transition means investing directly in those places, helping them to diversify their economies and build a new foundation that honors their heritage, but, you know, allows them to thrive in a different kind of future. It's about respecting people while we make these big, necessary changes.
That's right. And it means ensuring that the new green jobs are good jobs, with fair wages, benefits, and the right to unionize. The goal isn't just to swap a fossil fuel job for any old job, it's to ensure the clean energy economy creates widespread prosperity and opportunity. If it doesn't, as Frank said, it will fail politically.
This focus on political stability is a crucial point. The report also talks about how climate change is a threat multiplier, not just for economies, but for global peace and security. Carter, can you explain how climate change can lead to conflict?
Well, the mechanism, according to defense and intelligence analysts, is that climate change exacerbates existing tensions and vulnerabilities. It's rarely the single direct cause of a war, but it's like pouring gasoline on a fire that's already smoldering.
Can you give us an example?
Take a region that already has a history of ethnic tension and a fragile government. Now add a multi-year climate-driven drought. The water sources dry up. The pastures for livestock wither away. Crops fail. This leads to massive food and water scarcity, which in turn can drive resource competition between different groups. It can cause governments to collapse, create mass displacement, and open up a power vacuum that can be exploited by extremist groups. The climate stress is the catalyst that pushes a fragile situation into a full-blown crisis.
But hang on a minute. It seems to me that people have been fighting over land and water for thousands of years. How can we be so sure that this isn't just old conflicts playing out, and that we're just slapping a new climate change label on them? Is the link really that direct?
That's a fair question, Frank. And you're right, these are often old tensions. But what the science and the data show is a clear intensification. The droughts are more severe and longer lasting than before. The floods are more extreme. The report notes that the IPCC states with high confidence that climate extremes are increasingly driving displacement, and that displacement itself is a major source of instability. So it's not creating conflicts out of thin air, it's making existing ones far more frequent and far more deadly.
You know, when I hear this, I just think about the human cost. We see these headlines about instability in a faraway region, but we forget that these are families being forced to flee their homes because the land they have farmed for generations can no longer support them. They are not leaving because they want to, they are leaving because they have no choice. It connects directly back to that horrifying statistic you mentioned earlier, Carter, about the death rate from these disasters being 15 times higher in vulnerable regions.
It truly underscores the profound inequity of this crisis. And this idea of instability leads me to another geopolitical question. We've talked about how the energy transition changes the map of power from oil states to countries with critical minerals. Carter, how is this massive global shift changing the relationships between major world powers?
It's reshaping geopolitics in a fundamental way. For a century, international relations have been shaped by who has the oil and the gas. But in a world powered by renewables, the sources of power change. It shifts from countries with fossil fuel reserves to countries that lead in manufacturing the key technologies. So that's solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries. So we're just trading a dependency on oil from the Middle East for a dependency on batteries and solar panels from, say, China. It sounds like we're just swapping one set of geopolitical problems for another.
We're sitting vulnerable just in a different way.
That is a very real risk, Frank. And it's a major strategic concern for governments in Europe and North America. Creating more resilient, secure, and diversified supply chains for these clean energy technologies is a huge global priority right now. But there's also a fundamental upside to this new map.
And what that?
The resources for renewable energy. You know, sunlight and wind are far more democratically distributed around the globe than fossil fuel reserves are. Almost every single country has the potential to generate its own clean energy for its own people. Over the long run, this could lead to greater energy independence for many nations, reducing the number of global choke points and potentially leading to a more stable and equitable world.
That's a really hopeful thought. The idea that this transition, if we manage it right, could actually make the world a more peaceful place by giving more countries control over their own energy future.
It is. We've spent a lot of time talking about the failures of national governments and these huge geopolitical shifts, but we know a lot of the real-world changes are happening at a more local level. Carter, what does the report say about the role of cities in leading climate action?
In many cases, cities are where the action is. They are often more agile, more pragmatic, and less tied up in partisan gridlock than national governments. And they have to be, because they are on the front lines of the impacts, from heat waves to flooding. So you have these incredible networks like the C4 Cities Climate Leadership Group, which are basically hubs of innovation.
What kind of innovation are we talking about? What are cities actually doing on the ground that makes a difference?
They are doing a lot. They are electrifying their public transport fleets, from buses to garbage trucks. They are creating greener building codes that mandate higher energy efficiency. They are investing in massive tree planting campaigns and creating more parks to combat the urban heat island effect. They are redesigning streets to be more friendly for pedestrians and cyclists and less dominated by cars. All of these actions, when added up across hundreds of cities, have a huge impact on both emissions and the quality of life for residents.
And you can really feel that difference. You know, when your city invests in a new reliable bus line or a safe protected bike lane, your life gets better. Your commute is less stressful. The air feels cleaner. It's another one of those examples where the climate solution is also just a better way of living. It's not about sacrifice. It's about building cities that are more pleasant and more livable for everyone.
It truly seems a recurring theme is that a more sustainable world is also a healthier and more equitable one.
We have covered so much ground today. From the accelerating science of a planet in crisis, to the cascading impacts on our health, economy, and security, and to the immense challenges and emerging pathways in our global response.
As we draw this conversation to a close, I want to come back to a final forward-looking thought from each of you. We are standing at the end of this decade of consequence. The report makes it clear the window for action is closing with terrifying speed. Where do we go from here? Frank, what is your final takeaway?
For me, it has to be about getting real. The scale of this report shows that we are past the point of easy feel-good solutions. The transformation that is required is going to be hard, and it's going to be expensive. We need to stop pretending otherwise. The path forward has to be built on honesty about the costs, on ensuring the transition is fair to working people, and on deploying every single pragmatic tool we have, from renewables to nuclear to carbon capture, without letting ideology get in the way. It's an all-hands-on-deck emergency, and we need to start acting like it.
Thank you, Frank. A powerful call for pragmatic, honest, all-of-the-above action.
I keep coming back to that idea of the story we tell ourselves. For so long, the climate story has been framed by fear, by what we have to give up. And that fear is real. The grief for what we're losing is valid. But a story of fear alone can lead to paralysis. I believe we have to start telling a new story, a story of what we stand to gain. We gain a chance to build a world that is healthier, more just, and more connected to nature and to each other. That's the vision we have to hold on to. The way forward has to be rooted not just in fear of the future we want to avoid, but in a compelling, active hope for the future we want to create.
Thank you, Maya. A beautiful and necessary call for a new, more hopeful narrative. And Carter, I'll give you the final word. After laying out all this sobering science and the stark conclusions of this report, what is the ultimate message you want to leave our listeners?